Public confidence in the Supreme Court has plummeted to new lows in the last few years. In the past three decades, six conservative justices have gained a supermajority through questionable means, a dubious intervention in a presidential election, perjury during Senate testimony, and a GOP Senate leader's unethical blockade of a Supreme Court nomination. Behind this strategic dismantling of our Supreme Court is a vast, well-funded political machine backed by the extreme right-wing Federalist Society, the notoriously secretive Catholic organization Opus Dei, and GOP megadonors operating from behind closed doors. All of this according to David Brock, who had spent much time as in the conservative movement and now has written the new book Stench, The Making of the Thomas Court and the Unmaking of America. David is a Democratic activist and widely published author, and it is a great pleasure to welcome David Brock to the roundtable this morning. David, thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, thank you very much. Thanks for having me on.
At what point, as this was all happening and unraveling, did you start your work in putting this story together so that we could understand exactly the history of the making of this court?
Yes. Well, soon after the Dobbs decision came down, I realized, which is a couple years ago now, I realized that there was a big story to be told about the orchestrated effort by the right wing to bring about that result, which took almost 40 years and very intense philanthropy and organizing and strategy on the part of groups like the Federal Society, which was the main driver, but also evangelical voters. And that came together with very big right-wing self-interested money to bring about the supermajority, the MAGA majority that they have now. And so I go back and trace exactly how they did it.
So in that tracing, where, for your purposes, does this story begin?
Well, so I begin with, I go back to the Nixon administration, where some of the central players in the Federal Society, folks like Robert Bork and Lawrence Silberman, who is a federal judge in the D.C. Circuit, and Antonin Scalia, were all colleagues. And they came together beginning in the early 1980s, a decade later, to form the Federal Society. These were the key academic advisors to the Federal Society. And at the very first conference of the Federal Society, which began as a student-run organization, organizing like-minded students on college campuses. Their star keynote speaker was Robert Bork, and his maiden speech to the Federal Society was about the need to overturn Roe v. Wade, and was a kind of a culture war type speech in which he also questioned the legality of contraception and other things. And so from the word go, the Federal Society was committed to putting judges on the bench that would adhere to this agenda. And they did it in a very clever way. Basically, membership in the Federal Society became a kind of vetting or a kind of calling card for these judges, and not only judges, but executive branch appointees in the Justice Department and in top legal jobs throughout the government. If you were a member of it took being a member of the Federal Society to get these kinds of appointments and jobs. And so they did it partly in the public view, in that they had these conferences that were definitely covered by the press at the time. I went back and looked at some of the early coverage of it. But there was a stealth aspect of it, too, because they denied that it was an ideological organization. Basically, they pitched themselves as a student debating society. But what was really going on was a hardcore ideological movement, and they were able to kind of hide the ball in terms of what they were doing. So you got to a point where there were people up for federal judgeships who would go before the Senate and be asked about their membership in the Federal Society, and they would sit there and say they didn't know the Federal Society had any philosophy whatsoever. It was just a debating society, and of course that wasn't the case.
At what point did they become so powerful within the halls of government in the sense that their calls were being returned?
Well, it was really, in terms of the executive branch, it was really the George W. Bush administration where the Federal Society came to blossom. And throughout that administration, essentially all the key legal jobs from the White House Counsel's Office to the Justice Department were all held by Federal Society members. So that's when it kind of was at its peak power, until, of course, the deal that Donald Trump made with the Federal Society going all the way forward now to 2016, where because he was trying to shore up his support with evangelicals who were skeptical of Trump's well-documented personal behavior, he made a deal with the Federal Society and produced lists. The Federal Society produced lists that Trump pledged to pick from for his Supreme Court nominees. And so it was that pledge to pick the Federal Society vetted judges, together with the unconstitutional maneuver that year by Mitch McConnell, whereby Merrick Garland, the Obama appointee to the Supreme Court, never got a hearing, even though it was 10 months before the election and there was no constitutional grounds to deny Garland that hearing, but they did. And that made that open seat an issue in that election. So the two things came together. The evangelical voters were keyed into the fact that there was this open seat. And then you had Trump saying, well, here are the people I'm going to pick, and they're all going to overturn Roe v. Wade. And of course, that's exactly what happened when Trump got three appointees, all of whom went to the Senate under oath and said they would respect the precedent of Roe v. Wade, contrary to what they believed and contrary to what they did once they were on the court. And so there's an issue, I think, in terms of public perception of the court that has been very much stained by the fact that these judges misled the Senate and misled the public about their true intentions. And we got a decision that's very, very unpopular in the country.
So I want to get to that in just a moment, but I can't get away from Merrick Garland and what Mitch McConnell did, and 10 months before an election. Still, after all these years, how the hell did that happen? How was that allowed to happen? How did it happen? And in your estimation, in your opinion, could anything have been done from the sitting administration to have kept it from happening?
Yeah, well, it was really a Mitch McConnell power maneuver. I don't know that there's anything that really could have been done. I mean, he just outright refused to hold the hearing, and he had the cards in terms of doing that. I don't know if more public pressure could have been brought to bear, but I'm not sure, because I think Mitch McConnell held the cards, and it was real hardball. And that was really a complete, not only was it completely unconstitutional, but when Amy Coney Barrett comes along 4 years later, the McConnell idea of not putting a nominee up because you're in a presidential year went out the window, and it was a completely hypocritical 180 when they jammed Amy Coney Barrett through the confirmation process at the last minute leading up to the 2020 election, when people were already voting, early voting. They pushed that through. And so this is just, there's no principle attached to any of this.
When you go back to that particular decision, how much was the overturning of Roe on the mind of those who made sure that Merrick Garland was not going to get a seat on the Supreme Court of the United States?
Well, I think it was, because I think Mitch McConnell wanted to create an election issue for Donald Trump, and that's exactly what they did. And so it was clear that the pairing of Trump's pledge to support only pro-life judges with the open seat that created created the that I think basically elected Donald Trump.
So what is it about the, you know, create an election issue, but as you say, this is very unpopular. So did, for so long, after confirmation hearing after confirmation hearing after confirmation hearing, we heard that it's established law. And that was how those who sat before the Senate, who were to be chosen, were that's how they would respond. And yet, was that a lie? Was that the line? Or did they really think at some point that that was going to be the case?
No, I think that was a lie. I think you have to go back to, in the book, I go back to the Robert Bork hearings and I revisit those. And in that hearing, people will remember that Bork, who, as I mentioned, had this speech to the Federalist Society years ago about the need to overturn Roe, when he came to his Senate confirmation, if nothing else, Bork was very straightforward and about his views. And there was a huge backlash to that, and there was organized opposition to Bork. But when he got up there, he was honest about his beliefs, and of course that's what sunk his nomination. So the lesson that the right and the Federalist Society took from the Bork hearing was that they could never be forthcoming again with the Senate, and the nominees were coached to give answers like, we respect stare decisis on Roe, which is the precedent. That began with Clarence Thomas. Clarence Thomas had not only gotten himself awards from anti-abortion groups, but his wife, Ginny, is a well-known anti-abortion activist. And he sat there and said that that his personal views had nothing to do with how he would render this decision and that you had to respect precedent. And that was the beginning. And then, of course, the most egregious one, I think, was Brett Kavanaugh, who years later now met with Susan Collins, the senator, and to get her vote, said that he would be part of a team of nine and he would not rock the boat as a judge, and that he respected this as precedent. And of course, he went the opposite way once he was able to do so on the court. And Susan Collins came out and issued a pretty extraordinary statement saying that in that meeting, Brett Kavanaugh lied to her.
You were once a very important and a very vocal supporter of Clarence Thomas. Give us a sense of when that confidence started to erode.
Yeah, sure. So I wrote a book called The Real Anita Hill that was published back in 1993 after the hearings were over. And the book was an effort to attack Anita Hill's credibility and to show that Thomas was innocent of everything she had charged him with. I wrote it in good faith in the sense that I thought I was telling what the real story was. I was only presenting one point of view, which was Clarence Thomas's. And the book was done and sourced through all the folks very close to Clarence Thomas and the Republicans on the Judiciary Committee. And the book was published to a lot of fanfare, and Rush Limbaugh read it on the air for 3 days, and it was a cause celeb on the right. What happened was I got much closer to these folks subsequent to publishing the book. And over time, over the next 2 or 3 years, I came to understand that the people who had helped me with that book, who told me that Thomas was incapable of doing these things, had themselves had doubts about their own best friend. And these were folks who had told me the opposite. And so I began to put together that this was just a political operation. And while I take full responsibility for what I wrote, that basically I was used and sold a bill of goods. And once that set in, I was never really the same again, because it shook my foundations, because, again, I did not think I was just putting forth a false propaganda. I thought I had, you know, the truth on my side, and I did not.
I hope you forgive the naivete of this question, but I ask it in great curiosity. But How is he able to get so much from these quote-unquote best friends that we've seen over and over and over again, and for us not to expect that he is getting something, they are getting something in return?
Yeah, sure. Well, you know, I think Thomas is definitely bought and paid for. I don't necessarily think that he's changing his views to fit the billionaires who are giving him the gifts. I think these are his views. But what's really outrageous about it is that there are disclosure laws on the books right now. Forget the fact that there's no ethics requirements that apply to the Supreme Court, but there are laws like the Ethics in Government Act from 1978 that Thomas is in violation of by receiving these gifts and not disclosing them. And so I'm not saying that they buy his opinions, but I am saying that what he's done is very, very unethical. It's unprecedented and wrong, and he's definitely getting away with it.
The fact that there are no, I mean, what it seems that we have learned, I mean, we learned this in your book, but many of us have been learning this over the last several years, that there doesn't seem to be any guardrails, there doesn't seem to be any regulation, there doesn't seem to be anyone minding what is going on. Do you believe that will always be the case?
Well, it's a tough environment to talk about Supreme Court reform because of the election results.
Of course.
I think that you basically need a Democratic Congress to make progress on the front of having a real ethics regime. Now, the Roberts Court adopted their own rules in response to the outrage in the public over these gifts to Thomas, but those rules have no teeth. They're not enforceable, and it's still up to the justices themselves what they want to do on issues like recusal and on issues like disclosure. And so I think it's a very, you know, right now is a very tough environment to talk about any real reform. I mean, that has to be ultimately the goal. But I think that Republicans have dismissed the rightful concerns of people about what's going on up there. And that's why I call it a stench, which comes from the Sonia Sotomayor on the bench when they were arguing the Dobbs decision, said that if they do this and overturn Roe just because they have the votes to do it, there'll be a stench on the court. And that's exactly what's happened.
Why was this, and you may disagree with my statement, but why was this not a larger issue in the campaign? And even from the Harris campaign of saying of what was at stake with the Supreme Court of the United States of America?
Oh, yeah, I don't disagree at all. I think that it should have been. One of the reasons I wrote the book was to raise awareness of the issues. The organized right has been organizing their constituencies for many, many years to vote on the issues of the court. In 16, Hillary Clinton gave a really great speech about the stakes at the Supreme Court and talked about the fact that Trump could potentially get two or three appointments, which is what happened. But Democrats didn't pay any attention to that. It got very little media coverage at the time. And so the people, unfortunately, who were organized around this issue are the people on the right. And it's a minority, but it's a very committed minority. And I believe that there could have been some effective arguments made by Kamala Harris about the court. She did talk about Dobbs and she did talk about abortion, but she never connected it really to the fact that what could happen in this next administration is through the retirements of the older justices, Thomas and Alito, you could potentially Trump could have two or even three more appointments. And those dots were never connected for folks. And I think it was definitely a missed opportunity. I think the ethics issue needs to be personified and that Cut Thomas himself should have been called out on that. And I think that would have galvanized people.
Do you, we have 30 seconds left, but do you believe we will start to see retirements fairly soon?
I think so. I mean, what I have read is that Alito has said that he's not in any rush to retire. But I think that Alito and Thomas in this next 4 years certainly could leave the bench. And what you will get is Federal Society approved justices who are 30 years younger than each of them. And then we'll be in the situation for, you know, even more, another generation or two. And then, you know, there's also the issue of Sonia Sotomayor and her health not being great. God forbid there's a potential issue there, too. So there are opportunities for Trump. And then, you know, the other thing is it's not just the Supreme Court. It's the federal judiciary itself. And there'll be dozens and dozens and dozens of opportunities for Trump to put on hardcore, young Federal Society approved right. justices on those courts. And we will live with those consequences on every issue that everybody cares about, from the environment to abortion rights, voting rights.
David,
we'll live with those issues.
I apologize. We're out of time, but I thank you so much for being with us. The name of the book is Stench. It's published by Knopf. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.